The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2022, Living Liberation, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, you can visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Welcome, everyone. This talk is titled Distributing Freedom, How Package Managers Empower Software Users, and will be presented by Sebastian Crane. Sebastian is currently the Outreach Team Co-Chair for the SPDX Working Group, a project aiming to streamline free software license compliance and supply chain security through rich and comprehensive package metadata. Welcome, Sebastian. Great to have you here. I'm really curious to understand better the critical role of package managers and how important they really are in distributing freedom.
Thank you. So yes, hello and welcome. This is Distributing Freedom, How Package Managers Empower Software Users. So the story starts in the 1970s. And in the 1970s, there were no such thing as package managers. Most computers were mainframes or mini computers. Pictured on this slide is the Digital Equipment Corporation PDP-10, which was a mini computer. And I think mini computer to a modern eye might seem a little strange, but it was indeed quite a small computer for its time. These computers would serve multiple users. Each user would connect to the computer individually through their own keyboard and display. When a user wanted a piece of software that wasn't already installed on the system, they would have to call up the system administrator, or sysadmin, who would have to manually install the software for all the people who are using that computer. So it was really quite a manual process to install new software. In particular, the software was distributed as something known as a TAR, a tape archive. So the system administrator would have to buy a physical tape containing the source code in this format. So the sysadmin would extract the source code onto the computer, compile it and link it into the final program, and then move that into a path on the system's file system where the end user could access it. So all in all, this was a big job to install any new software. When personal computers were invented in the 80s and 90s, it became quite apparent that individuals couldn't have a sysadmin all to themselves. They would have to do it themselves. And so package managers were a concept that allowed the PC user to install, update, and remove the software on their own without having specialist knowledge. Pictured here is the IBM 5150, which is the first personal computer as we know them now. So within the space of about 5 years in the mid-90s, all the free operating systems started exploring the concept of package management. The first was probably 1993's Bogus Linux package management system. Bogus Linux is no longer around, but it certainly had a legacy. Just a year later, FreeBSD released its package suite. That's pkg underscore install, pkg underscore remove, and so on and so forth. Debian released dpkg, which became the foundation of apt-get and apt, which you're no doubt familiar with if you've ever used a Debian-based operating system. Red Hat released Red Hat Package Manager, or RPM. It was very similar to dpkg, and also became the foundation of Yum and DNF. And Gentoo created Portage, which is very similar to the FreeBSD package suite. What all of these package managers have in common are a set of features. The most basic feature is installing software. Given a package, the software can be automatically compiled, or if it was compiled before, simply installed into the right place on the system for it to be used. So you could install software with a single command. Likewise, it was important to be able to remove software cleanly without leaving any traces. And so package managers were able to remove the packages that had been installed. Package managers could present to the user information about which packages were installed. The late 90s brought a specific development which was extremely important: the ability to search and download packages from the internet. This was a relatively new concept at the time. Most people didn't have access to the internet at this point. But it did make things far easier, because you wouldn't have to buy a catalogue of software and then purchase tapes or cassettes in advance. Finally, package managers had a feature called automatic dependency resolution, and I'll explain that on the next slide. An application doesn't just exist in itself. Most applications need libraries to run, pieces of software that they call as part of their operation. So in this hypothetical example, we have a calendar application shown at the bottom of the diagram. This is what the user wants to install on their personal computer. When the user tells the package manager to install the calendar application, not only does it download the calendar application from the internet, but it also downloads a library. In this case, say libnotify. This library is a real-life library and exists to notify users with pop-ups. And there's another feature that package managers had and still have for automatic dependency resolution, which allows for options. Say this program, the calendar application, requires running on Java. It can list in its dependencies a Java JRE, which is a virtual package. It doesn't exist in the real world. However, the virtual package specifies two other packages that can satisfy itself. So for here, I've got Azul Zulu JRE and Oracle's OpenJDK JRE. Now, both of these builds of Java would be useful and would satisfy the calendar application's need. So by using virtual packages, you can ensure that at least one will be installed, but it gives the user an option. So package managers remained mostly the same for the next 10 to 15 years. There were, of course, gradual improvements, and new distributions also were created and had package managers created for them. So in particular, Alpine Linux and Arch Linux had package managers which were similar to the BSD's and Gentoo's package manager. Probably the biggest and most important thing of this period was that package managers came to mobile devices like smartphones. So pictured on this slide is the Nokia N9. Travis Goodspeed, a well-known hardware hacker, related a story to me about this model. It had a stack based on Linux, GNU, and Qt, and its package management system was dpkg. from Debian. The phone had a security system that prevented harmful programs from taking over the phone. But as you might understand, some users wanted to tinker around and break out of these restrictions. And so it turned out that the D package would run the installation scripts, the mini programs that install the program that was requested, as root, the user on Linux systems that can do anything. So just by installing a specially crafted package, you could get access to everything on the smartphone. Now, this is very benign, maybe slightly misguided from a security perspective, but it was a perfectly legal way to tinker around with devices. Unfortunately, this was about to change. At around this time, the proprietary operating systems of the world began to take note of this feature and develop their own package management systems. In 2008, the Apple App Store was released for the iPhone 3G, and it provided a graphical, easy-to-use package manager with a special selection of apps. Fortunately, these were all proprietary apps. Proprietary meaning that the user wasn't allowed to modify them and then share the result of those modifications, as opposed to free software, which grants those rights to the end user. Google's Android wasn't far behind, and the same year released Android Market. It also came to desktop PCs. In 2009, the proprietary operating system Windows had a package manager created for it called Nynite. And I remember lots of buzz in the press around this, because it was probably the first exposure to package management for a large sector of the population who were used to proprietary operating systems like Windows. Microsoft created their own first-party app store called Windows Store a couple of years later. And finally, Google Play was made from Android Market and still exists on Google phones today. These app stores encouraged software developers, proprietary software developers, to sell their software very cheaply, or maybe give them away completely for free. And in order to keep the profits up, they added features that were maybe a little unsavory from the user's perspective. These include pay-to-win features in games, if you can call them features, because many say they inhibit the enjoyment of the game. Advertisements in applications, I can see how they would be very distracting when you're trying to get on with work. Privacy-limiting analytics, or tracking software, was another rather unsavory addition to many applications which had previously been free of it. Luckily for the cause of free software, most of these proprietary app stores are actually quite limited. They provide some features, but the features are often stifled. They aren't exposed to the user in all their power. This means that there's still a lot of room for free software package managers to improve and to make users' lives better. I'll go over four of the features that they have right now and that you can use right now on a free operating system. So the first one here is stability. Stability is about ensuring that the whole system is reliable and can recover from faults. Automatic dependency resolution, which I covered earlier, is especially useful because it absolves the user of the responsibility to go through each package and work out what it requires. This means that the software can be more reliable. It always gets the right dependencies and never ones that are incompatible. Once the package is no longer needed, the package manager can also uninstall all of the dependencies. And that's a very useful feature. If you've used a proprietary operating system, you might have come across ghost files, which is a side effect of some of these systems not having package managers. They leave traces of previous programs. The users can easily remove a program if it's faulty. that's very useful because you don't want programs that sort of work and sort of don't cluttering up your computer. And finally, some free software package managers allow the user to roll back to a previous working version when something goes catastrophically wrong. Free licensing is another feature that empowers users. Free software relies on free licenses to grant the user the right to use, modify, study, and share the code of any piece of software. These licenses are legal documents. So the package manager can display information about the software's license, and that helps users in identifying whether they have those four freedoms or not. In addition, many software distributions repositories of packages have policies which specify what can be included in the repositories. Debian, for instance, has the Debian Free Software Guidelines, and Fedora has a similar policy called the Good List. This includes things like all software must be free software and gives a definition of that, but also that the associated documentation and help guides must also be freely copyable. Some package managers are starting to use SPDX license identifiers. These further reduce the complexity of trying to work out licensing for software because they have SPDX license identifiers are short names that uniquely represent a license for a piece of software. An example of this might be the GPL-3.0-or-later identifier. This helps absolve any concerns around which version of the GNU General Public License a program is under. This is a very important feature for companies that use free software and don't want to take on legal risk by doing so. I think this really helps the adoption of free software in corporate or government type scenarios. Package managers provide users with security. Packages are cryptographically signed. So when the package is built, it is signed with a private key. This signature can then be verified by the package manager to make sure that they're authentic, that the package has been made by the person who it claims to have been made by, and that it's undamaged, that it hasn't been corrupted while being downloaded, for instance. You may have heard that most websites use a protocol called HTTPS, or secure HTTP. But package managers often use plain HTTP. They can do this while remaining secure, because the signatures are on the level of the package. You can still use HTTPS with many package managers, and that gives you extra privacy and anonymity. So people can see that you're downloading a package, but nobody can find out which package you were downloading. Another security feature of package managers is the ability to automatically update when there are security vulnerabilities discovered in a piece of software. So you may have a notification on your computer that you're running an outdated piece of software, and it will tell you if there are any vulnerabilities that you need to update to mitigate the risk for. Ease of use seems almost obvious, but it is a very important part of user empowerment. I've got pictured on this slide GNOME software, which is a graphical program that users can use to discover and download pieces of software. So there are repositories of tens of thousands of packages, and you can browse these and search for packages within these and use a graphical interface like this to download them and install them without requiring any technical knowledge of the command line, for instance. Finally, I would like to express my feelings about what the future of package management could hold. There's a lot left to be explored in this field, and I've picked four categories of development which I think will become more prevalent in the next 5 to 10 years. Not only do package managers empower users today, but I think they will be able to do so much more in the coming years. So remote control is probably one of the most immediate advantages that could come to package management. As users have more and more devices around the home, including televisions, mobile devices like smartphones and tablets, even home appliances like thermostats, it becomes ever increasingly difficult and time-consuming to update all of them. And yet doing so is very important when they might have security vulnerabilities. By having a, for instance, a web console that you can log into and update all of your devices from the same portal would be especially useful. Pictures on this slide is the web interface of Cockpit, which is a program that you can already use to do such a thing. It's not universally supported, but you can install it on any Linux machine, and I think it might work on other GNU systems as well. Another feature that is going to become more and more important in the future is application containerization. Containers allow the separation of programs. There are two chief reasons to do this. One is for sandboxing. This means that the programs are unable to communicate with each other, and they can only access particular parts of the computer's resources which you allocate to them. For instance, if you have a video watching program, you may want to allow it access to all your private videos and photographs, but not allow it access to the network. This helps you ensure that you have privacy over those files. The other advantage is that it allows users to run software which traditionally would have been a conflicting combination and wouldn't have worked. An example that comes to mind is the libc, which is a fundamental part of GNU systems. And there's an alternative stack to this called Moozle libc. And it's almost impossible to run both at the same time on traditional computer systems. But containers allow you to do this with relative ease. The current technologies for this containerization include Flatpak and OCI runtimes, that is, Open Container Initiative runtimes. The OCI runtimes that you might have heard of include Podman and Docker. Declarative management of computer software is another thing that I think is going to become increasingly useful and widespread in package management. So with current package managers, you declare the packages you want installed one by one. Install this, install that. But in a fully declarative system, you list them all in one file, and the package manager will work out what it needs to do to get to your final result. One advantage of this is that it's easy to move between computers. If you have one file where all of the packages you require are listed, it's very convenient to be able to copy that to another machine and install all of your packages together. The same advantage applies to large deployments of software, maybe 100 machines in an office. You can have one declarative file and use that to install software on all of those machines together. Nix, GNU Geeks, and Fedora Silverblue are probably the most leading examples of this technology. Fedora Silverblue isn't purely declarative in its package level management, but it has a lot of similar features due to its container-based approach. Finally, there's a feature which is close to my work and close to my heart, which is supply chain security. This is in addition to the security features I mentioned earlier, which already exist, cryptographic signing, for instance. This is an emerging problem with deep dependency trees. Not only does a program depend on a library or two, but it depends on libraries that depend on libraries that depend on libraries, and so on and so forth. And it can be very hard to find vulnerable code within that huge tree of dependencies. This means that an issue with one package very deep down in the tree can spread quite easily to lots of people. Automatic security audits is a feature that's being developed at the moment. And if you combine them with software bill of materials, or SBOMs, which are ingredients lists of software components, you can alert users that the packages may be vulnerable. So I could find out that my calendar application was vulnerable, not because it had a problem, but because one of the many dependencies that it might have has a problem. And I'm sure you can see how that will become ever more important as software stacks get bigger and not smaller, as is the trend in computing. Provenance data is about where the software came from. The package you get is a binary program that you install on the computer, but there might be multiple stages of distribution leading back to when it was initially compiled and before that when it was initially written. So provenance data is about this supply chain and creating a manifest of that supply chain so that you can work out whether software is legitimate. The attestations is a feature that allows you to work out whether the machine that created the package, that took the source code and put it into the format that you can install, was secure in itself. It's no good if it has a vulnerability, because then you can't trust any package that that machine might have made. I used plenty of images for this talk, and they're all credited here. So thank you very much to these people who created these pictures and put them up onto Wikimedia Commons, a place where you can find many free software, free culture, openly available resources. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to hearing any questions you might have. And if you don't get time to ask them in this Q&A section, then feel free to contact me at any time. My email address is cbas@fsfe.org.
Thank you, Sebastian. It was a very well presented talk, lots of information, very well structured and very well presented.
Thank you very much. I look forward to hearing what people have thought while listening to it and to taking any questions that there might be.
I see a question regarding Flatpak. The audience member asks regarding Flatpak, is there a separate repository out there for only free software as an alternative or addition to FlatHub?
I'm not sure of any such alternative repository existing at the moment, but what FlatHub does have is, I believe they have SPDX license identifiers for each Flatpak package, and GNOME software with the Flatpak extension can already display whether or not a piece of software is proprietary based on that information. So I think one could take that a step further and have one repository, which may include proprietary software, but the user tooling can warn users of that and alert them to that potential risk. And if there is such a free software only Flatpak repository, I'd very much be interested to hear about that.
Another question is, have you seen any promising work for reducing the duplication of effort for distribution-specific package managers, either current or historical? And the question goes on, one of the complexities that makes packages between operating systems is the different versions of glibc.
Yes, so the first part of that, I think, has been greatly improved by build systems, and the first of those, is the Auto Tools, GNU Auto Tools. But since then, a number have been created, and one of the latest is Meson. And that has a very convenient sort of domain-specific language. And I've compiled maybe hundreds or thousands of Meson programs, and it doesn't take too much to go a step further and package them in operating system-specific formats. But I personally would be very much in support of distribution cooperation to produce one package manager that can be used in lots of different contexts. I think that would be a fantastic way forward. And for the second part of the question, I think that was about GNU Libc.
Yeah.
So the this is where containers come in useful, because the in traditional systems, the GNU Libc library is in one place on the operating system, and you can only ever have one version at a time. And whilst the distributions do try and make sure the versions are compatible, it does occasionally run into problems when you have lots of different versions, old software running with new software. And the advantage of containers is that you can create a box around boxes, in which you can have a different version of GNU Libc than is running on the host machine. So containers are a very practical way of getting around that. And I would recommend you looking into something like Podman and learning how to do that so that you can run different versions of GNU Libc.
And as I understand, you can do that without like a functional package manager like Nix, right?
Yes.
Obviously, you gave many examples, so that's really great.
Yes, Nix is very advanced in this respect.
Yeah. So we have another question. It's, what's your opinion on language-specific package managers? Example, pip for Python, cargo for Rust, etc.
Yeah, I was thinking about this one recently because it is a lot of duplication of effort. When you talk about the distributions duplicating effort, it's possibly even more prevalent in programming languages. And on one hand, I can see that it's a good excuse to try out the new programming language, to create its own package manager in the language. But it does mean that programming language package managers often lag behind in features because they are they're built from scratch for every programming language. So I would hope that generic package managers like Nix and GNU Geeks could help alleviate this. And I think it's definitely not sustainable to have different package managers for each programming language. And I hope that they converge onto at least a standard, and then have different implementations of that.
Yeah, I can see how, like, for using different package managers for every single language may create like unnecessary friction also, like,
yes,
software that depends on components from different programming languages.
Yeah. There's a wonderful XKCD comic about this, with the fictional user's Python setup, and it has sort of 20 boxes with arrows going between them of the different package management software they have for Python. It's quite amusing, but unfortunately very true.
Right. And also, like, you cannot have, like, unless you have a package manager that checksums the package, you cannot have the same package name, for example, for the same package in different languages, or otherwise it will have conflicts. But I think Nix could probably fixes that.
Yes. So GNU Geeks, Nix, and SPAC all have this feature where the packages are labeled with a hash, or at least a string that looks like a hash, and you run a command to go into its environment. It's a bit like a container, but it's a bit faster and uses the native system.
Also, I had a personal question. If it's all right, do you think we can decentralize repositories and make that work with the package managers we have currently?
Yes, I think it would be good to decouple the distribution from the package manager. And there are some efforts to do that. For instance, Ubuntu has different repositories from Debian and uses the same package manager. But I think all in all, if the repositories were decentralized, but the distribution repackaged those in a convenient format, in a cohesive format, for instance, a distribution specific for scientific computing would have scientific packages. That would be very useful. It's sort of been done already, but not to a great extent. And I'd definitely be in support of decentralized package ecosystems where distributions act as sort of curated selections rather than sources of truth.
Right. The source of truth is like the hashes of the packages and the source codes, and that can be distributed well, and then you don't have to worry about if the hashes are distributed well and decentralized and verifiably secure, then we can trust the packages wherever they come from.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the my last slide on supply chain security alluded to some of those features, where you have a provenance chain which has all the different signatures. So you've got the person who originally created the software, the first person to package it, distributions that base on distributions, and you can search back and forth through that to see if you trust the piece of software.
I think we have answered all the questions in the IRC, and I have also asked you, and you have answered the question I had in my mind for perhaps more than a year, like decentralizing the signatures, the hashes. So anything else you want to cover or touch on before we conclude?
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to repeat my email address, because I'm aware that not everyone will be able to ask questions here. So that's cbas@fsfe.org. And please feel free to send me an email at any time, and I'll do my best to respond. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Sebastian. Thank you for all the great information, and thank you for presenting this talk so well.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.